right. Well, I guess short introduction. We'll have Dave Alloway from Oregon DEQ. And Dave,
great.
Take it away.
Okay. Thanks very much. Okay. Is the mic on? It sounds like it is. Great. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for inviting me to speak. I'd like to echo Loretta Pickerel's comments from this morning and welcome you to Portland and Oregon, and hope that you have some time to get out and enjoy our fair city, in addition to enjoying your time here at the conference. As I'm welcoming you to Oregon, I thought I might reflect for a moment on Tom McCall, who was a Republican who was governor of Oregon a few decades ago. I met Governor McCall when I was about 6, so you can figure out roughly how old I am if you're quick at math. And my dad, for some reason, I don't know what, took us down to the Capitol to meet Governor McCall. And I didn't know what a Capitol was exactly, except it was where the governor worked. And I didn't know what a governor was either, but it was very imposing because it was this huge building with this big marble dome, and on top of the dome is this oversized gold statue of a really big man carrying a really big axe. That's what we have on our Capitol here in down in Salem. And that was very frightening to me. So the governor, he like sits underneath this big guy with the axe, and so we go up the stairs, big marble stairs, and stand in front of this very large door, and suddenly the door opens, and out comes this very tall man. McCall is about 6.5 feet tall, and he was wearing a business suit, and over the suit, over his suit, he was wearing a burlap potato sack with holes cut for his neck and arms. Apparently he was doing like a photo shoot with the Oregon Potato Commission or something. I don't know. I mean, something. At this point, I was so scared, I was speechless. I couldn't, he shook my hand and I just couldn't say anything at all. And that was sort of my first exposure to working for state government. I guess you got this big axe and you wear these potato sacks and something like that. Look where I ended up many years later. Governor McCall cared deeply about protecting Oregon's environment. He signed laws creating the Oregon DEQ, protecting all of Oregon's coastal beaches from private development, and creating Oregon's bottle bill and system of land use planning. And in a nationally televised interview in 1971, Governor McCall invited Americans to come visit us again and again, he said, but for heaven's sake, don't come here to live. I don't know very many governors these days who would make a statement quite as audacious as that. And I don't want you to take it personally, any of you. But that was the era that I grew up in here in Oregon. And when I, in the 1980s, went away to college in Minnesota, Oregon still kind of carried with it this somewhat quirky reputation. Or perhaps I should say when I went back east to college in Minnesota, because that's how my neighbors referred to Minnesota. They said, oh, you're going back east. Mm. And, of course, I had friends in college from the East Coast who referred to being in Minnesota as being out here in the West, which I thought was absolutely ridiculous. Minnesota is no more out west than, well, anyways. So I'm sharing these stories with you to illustrate how reasonable people can look at the same issue and view it entirely differently depending on their frame of reference. Minnesota can be and is both back east and out west, depending on where you're looking at it from. And a pro-environment Republican who wears potato sacks over his business suits can mean very different things to different people. I think the view of solid waste also depends on one's frame of reference. To many people, the problem of solid waste is a problem of landfills. Landfills are sources of toxic pollution. They're major emitters of greenhouse gases. They're filling up rapidly, causing waste to be transported by truck or rail longer and longer distances with resulting increasing uses of petroleum and tailpipe emissions. And all that is a very bad thing. And so we need to recycle and compost. We need to recycle and compost to keep stuff out of landfills, because landfills are bad and they're filling up. And this is what I've just described, is a very popular frame of reference in this country. It's how many people view the problem of solid waste. And certainly in some parts of the country, the problem of limited landfill capacity is chronic. And everything in this frame of reference that I just described is basically true and accurate. But unfortunately, it's very incomplete. It leaves out some other much more important and much more compelling points. And as such, this popular frame of reference, I believe, leads solid waste managers and the media and elected officials and the general public to what I think is a rather peculiar and sometimes counterproductive view of materials and waste. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. For those of you who are participating via the webcast, I'm going to periodically call out the slide number, so we're now on slide number 3. What I'm going to do is share with you summaries of 3 separate instances where the Oregon DEQ has used life cycle inventory analysis, an accounting of the raw materials used and the pollution produced over the life cycle of a product, from raw materials extraction all the way through to end-of-life management, to examine various elements of materials and waste. And I hope to leave with you a sense of the potential benefits of using LCA in your work in policy and program development, and the benefits of viewing the world from a different frame of reference. Due to time constraints, I'm not going to go into great detail about any of these 3, and I'm also not going to talk about the limitations of LCA, but I will be available afterwards, both during this conference and after this conference as well, if any of you or your staff would like to talk with me about any of these issues, I'd be happy to do so. So the first example I'm going to share is an analysis that we conducted back in 2004, when our current governor, Ted Kulongoski, convened a high-level advisory group on global warming. 7 technical subcommittees were formed to assist this advisory group. One of the technical subcommittees is the Technical Subcommittee on Waste. And as its chair, one of my first actions was to change the name to the Technical Subcommittee on Materials and Waste. Why? Due to what I think is some really outstanding work by EPA, I knew that the greenhouse gas benefits of prevention and recycling are primarily upstream in resource extraction and manufacturing of materials, and that these greenhouse gas benefits have relatively little to do with landfill or landfill-related emissions. EPA's work that I'm referring to is nicely summarized in this recently updated report, and there's the URL if you want to check it out if you haven't already. In it, EPA uses a life cycle approach to estimate the greenhouse gas emissions and offsets associated with a variety of different waste management options for 25 or so different materials. I don't know the exact number. The documentation in this report is great, and we've derived incredible benefits from EPA's research in this area. So thank you very much, EPA, for your support of this very, very valuable work. You're going to be hearing more about EPA's WARM model software for modeling the greenhouse gas benefits of different waste management options in Sarah Hartwell's presentation later this afternoon, so I'm not going to go into detail about that. We didn't use the WARM model in our work for the governor's advisory group, but we did use the emissions factors that underlie the WARM model and that are described in this report, and these greatly simplified our own analysis. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about greenhouse gas accounting. Let's see a show of hands. Those of you on the webcast can raise your hands too, but no one is going to see them, so it's up to you. For those of you who are from states, from state governments, how many of your states have developed a state greenhouse gas inventory? Raise your hand. Okay, less than 10%. How many of your state environmental programs have conducted an inventory or an estimate just of the greenhouse gas emissions from landfills? Maybe 10%. Okay. How many of you have conducted an evaluation of the greenhouse gas benefits of recycling and composting in your state? Slightly fewer than 10%. Okay. And now here's a real curveball. How many of you have developed an estimate of the greenhouse gas impact of the entire life cycle of the materials that become waste in your state, including production? Okay. Not easy to do, but it's these upstream emissions involved associated with production of manufactured goods that are typically very large but outside the scope of most state greenhouse gas inventories. For those states that have conducted inventory, it seems like most have looked at the landfill-related emissions, but even that, very few. I was surprised at how few have done that here. But most greenhouse gas accounts, state greenhouse gas accounts, don't examine the full impact of the consumer behaviors, the buying of the stuff and making of the waste in the first place. So what we have on slide 6 is the results of the conventional greenhouse gas accounting applied to Oregon for the year 2000. These are pretty standard categories of greenhouse gas emissions that various state accounts use. Most of the emissions are associated with electricity and transportation and other fossil fuels used for heating and industrial applications. And then solid waste disposal, this is net emissions, are only about 1% of the statewide total. However, when we look upstream and we look at all the materials that become waste in Oregon and look at the greenhouse gas emissions associated with producing those materials, we find that for the average ton of stuff, of course, different materials have different impacts, but for the average ton, the greenhouse gas impacts of production are at least 10 times higher than the greenhouse gas emissions associated with disposal. Okay? So materials overall contribute at least 10% to the statewide greenhouse gas emissions for Oregon. Probably more than 10%. 10 is probably an underestimate. Now, where are all these emissions? Because they don't show up in this pie chart on slide 6. Well, most of them are sort of hidden here in what's called other fossil fuels. This includes fuels burnt in industrial processes, you know, where stuff is being made. And then transportation, this includes freight-related impacts. And then there's also emissions associated with the use of electricity to make stuff as well. So these emissions involved that are associated with producing the stuff that becomes waste are significant, but they don't show up in most conventional greenhouse gas accounts. Even if the state wanted to account for these, they'd find it very challenging because most of the emissions that occur, for example, in producing the goods that Oregonians use, most of those emissions don't occur inside Oregon because they're associated with manufacturing and resource extraction elsewhere in other states. And those emissions should, in theory, be captured by some other state's greenhouse gas inventory. And you need to avoid the problem of double counting, so it becomes very complicated. This issue of sort of interstate emissions and follow materials through the stream of commerce applies to the problem of national accounts as well. And there's this really interesting study that was recently published by a couple of professors at Carnegie Mellon University. And what they did was to estimate the greenhouse gas emissions associated with producing consumer products that Americans buy, given the production of those consumer products in the United States, and also the production of those consumer products by our major trading partners. I think they looked at our seven or eight largest trading partners. So they estimate the emissions embodied in the products that we import and also embodied in the products we export. What we export, those emissions, of course, are included in our national accounts because the products are made here. But for all the stuff that's made in China, for example, that we buy, those emissions are allocated to China's national account, and they don't show up in the national greenhouse gas account for the United States. And it turns out that this is a very significant omission, emission omission. Okay, got that? It wasn't that large a few years ago. Back in 1997, the authors estimated that the net embodied carbon dioxide emissions in U.S. trade, the difference between exports and imports, was only somewhere between 0 and 5% above and beyond our national inventory, okay? Because we were importing a little bit more than we were exporting. How things have changed since 1997. They now estimate that the net embodied emissions in U.S. trade, and this doesn't include transport, this is just production, okay? Somewhere between 5 and 21% above and beyond our national greenhouse gas account. Okay, so consumer purchasing activities in the United States are resulting in greenhouse gas emissions that are not captured in the state or national accounts because of where the emissions occur. And this rapid increase between 1997 and 2004 is a consequence of two different trends. One, our increasing trade imbalance, where we're importing much more than we're exporting. We're basically outsourcing our pollution to other countries, but also our increasing trade and particularly our increasing imports from countries with very carbon-intensive economies, primarily China. Regardless, that was theory. Let's come back to practice for a moment. We find that the greenhouse gas potential of recycling is very large. Every state counts recovery a little bit differently. Some states count construction debris and other states don't, and some states count auto bodies and other states don't. In Oregon, what we call counting recovery, we don't go into detail what that means, we estimate using the EPA WARM model that recovery in Oregon, this is recycling and composting and a little bit of energy recovery, reduced greenhouse gas emissions over the entire life cycle globally by about 3.3 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. To put that number in context, it's the equivalent of 4.5% of our total statewide greenhouse gas emissions, emissions associated with all the energy that's used across the state of Oregon. Or it's the equivalent of removing just over 700,000 average passenger cars from the state. And given that our population is less than 4 million, removing 700,000 average passenger cars is very significant. This is a pretty big deal, these greenhouse gas benefits. In our work for the Governor's Advisory Group, we were evaluating a variety of different policy and program options. And these were public meetings, and there was an individual from one of the private companies, in private recycling companies in Oregon, who came to the technical subcommittee and said, you know, there are greenhouse gas emissions from the tailpipes of collection vehicles, right? And because they burn diesel, and there's carbon dioxide emissions, and so collecting recyclables contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. And so wouldn't it make sense to drive fewer trucks around? If we could have fewer collection trucks driving around, we'd reduce our emissions, right? People were very concerned about the emissions associated with the collection fleet. And so it was proposed that perhaps Oregon, which most of our communities offer weekly curbside collection from households, should go to every other week collection. So we conducted a little evaluation of an average 100 tons of curbside recyclables. And we found that the emissions associated with the fuel used in the collection vehicles to collect that 100 tons of mixed recyclables was about 4 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. Okay? That's associated with collection. But then once those recyclables are collected and they get sent off to industry, and industry uses them to displace virgin feedstock in production, we find a net greenhouse gas reduction of about 235 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, about 60 times greater than the greenhouse gases required to collect the recyclables. Okay? So reducing the frequency of curbside collection would cause the quantity of curbside recyclables to fall. We know that because the programs would be less convenient. So reducing the frequency of curbside collection in order to reduce emissions associated with a collection fleet is penny-wise and pound-foolish. You save a little bit of emissions associated with your collection vehicle, but your net impact would be an increase in greenhouse gas emissions because you would lose tonnage, and tonnage is what it's all about, getting that tonnage to market and getting it used by industry to displace virgin feedstock in production. That's what really drives this equation. Now, if recycling has greenhouse gas benefits, waste prevention benefits are even larger. Ton for ton, prevention has even better greenhouse gas reductions than recycling for most materials. How many of you, again from the state, let's see another show of hands, either have a statutory or some other waste recovery goal for your state? A lot of states have a 50% goal or a 40% recovery goal or a 30%, either in statute or a solid waste plan. Somewhere, let's see. Okay, looks like about half, maybe. So how many of you have, as states have a statutory or some other waste prevention goal to prevent the generation of waste, to reduce waste generation? Show of hands? Fewer, far fewer. Okay, maybe 10%. Oregon does. We have both recovery goals and prevention goals, and we evaluated the greenhouse gas impact of achieving these goals as part of our work for the Governor's Advisory Group. And what slide are we on here? This is slide 10, I think. Yeah. Slide 10 shows this graphically. This is a projection out to the year 2025. This is metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. And the pink line is our projection of what was called the business as usual scenario. Business as usual assumes that the recovery rate stays at 47%, which is where it was when we did this analysis. It's since then gone up slightly. And that per capita waste generation in Oregon continues to grow, as it has since we've been tracking since 1992, and also that population continues to grow. And the pink line is the greenhouse gases over the entire life cycle of the materials that become waste in Oregon. So then the blue line shows that same projection if we achieve the 50% recovery goal. It's a slight reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. The greenhouse gas benefit of recovery is much larger than this graph suggests. Remember, this is the marginal increase. We're only going from 47% recovery to 50% recovery, so it's a small incremental increase. But if we were to achieve our statutory waste generation goals, which are going to be difficult to achieve, but if we would achieve them, then the greenhouse gas emissions would look like this red line here. So very large greenhouse gas benefits associated with achieving our waste prevention goal. And in order to achieve these statutory goals, we're developing a waste prevention strategy framework to help us figure out how to more effectively focus on prevention and reuse. And I can talk more about that during Q&A if you'd like. So one of the great things about this work is that it's really appreciated by our partners in local governments and private industry. Global warming is a really big topic right now here in Oregon, and building on the groundwork laid by EPA, our analyses are being used by our partners in local governments and also DEQ staff to demonstrate the relevance of our work in prevention, recycling, and composting. And we've just gotten a lot of really positive feedback from our local partners about that. The next topic I want to look at is energy. Our work here was driven by concern among local governments and hauling companies over rising fuel prices and increasing interest in energy recovery. Local programs were talking more about reducing the frequency of curbside collection to save fuel, or maybe going to more alternative local recycling markets instead of shipping materials long distances, and maybe even dropping certain materials from recycling programs altogether if the markets were not local. Again, we were very fortunate to be able to use the resources developed by EPA, which are summarized in this report and now incorporated into the WARM model. So that collection analysis we did for greenhouse gases, we did that for energy as well. Again, an average 100 tons of mixed curbside recyclables in Oregon, we think it requires around 54 million BTUs in fuel for the on-route collection. But when those 100 tons of recyclables get to market and industry uses them to displace virgin feedstock in production, the energy savings are 26 times larger. So curbside recycling is a very good investment in energy efficiency. You put one unit of energy into your curbside fleet, and you get 26 units of saving out on the back end. That's a tremendous rate of return. I hope you'd all agree. So in the big picture of things, the fuel used by collection fleets is not as important as many people in the solid waste community intuitively believe them to be. And that's not to say that we shouldn't have really efficient collection fleets and consider alternative fuels and whatnot. But in the big picture, the energy savings is by industry, and it swamps the energy used in collection. Many people are also concerned and have asked us about the energy used to transport recyclables long distances. We find that that's also less significant than many people intuitively believe. Now, if you know how much energy a industry saves when it uses recycled feedstock in production and displaces virgin materials, and we're now on slide 14 here. If you know that and you know how much energy is used to transport a ton of recyclables by truck, rail, or freighter, you can calculate what I call the break-even point. This was an extension of the work that EPA did. We extended this to calculate these break-even points for different materials. The break-even point is the point at which you're using as much energy to transport your recyclables as industry is saving in using those recyclables. So your goal, of course, is not to transport your recyclables more than the break-even point. If you do, you're being a net user of energy from a life cycle perspective. Well, for aluminum shipped by ocean freighter, the break-even point is a little over 500,000 miles, which is equivalent to sending the aluminum to the moon. That's how far you could send it before you use more energy in transport than the aluminum smelters save by displacing the use of virgin resources. Even glass, which has relatively low energy savings, you can ship that by rail 5,100 miles, which is all the way across the continental United States, before you're using more energy in transporting it to market than industry is saving by using that glass to displace virgin feedstock. So on slide 15, we have a very interesting example from Ontario, Oregon. This is a small community out on the Idaho border. And of all the cities that are required by the Oregon Recycling Opportunity Act that are required to provide recycling service, Ontario is the farthest from a traditional glass market. Okay? So there's a couple of different things that people in Ontario could do with their glass once they collect it for recycling. There is a local market for glass. It can be crushed up and used as an aggregate displacement, okay, to displace the mining of a gravel for roadbeds. And we calculate, based on EPA's work and some very rough assumptions, that there is a small net energy benefit to using glass in that manner. Now, another thing that Ontario could do with its glass is they could ship it all the way across Oregon, more than 300 miles, by truck, to a glass plant that we have up in Portland, right next to the airport. You might have seen it when you came in. And that glass coating will be used to make new glass containers. And even after subtracting out the energy required for transportation, the net energy savings are 10 times higher than the energy savings of using the glass as aggregates. Okay? Now, there's something else that could be done with this glass. It could be driven all the way to Portland in a truck and then put into a rail car and shipped by rail all the way to California to be used to make fiberglass. And after subtracting out all the energy that's used to transport the recyclables for that long journey, we find that the net energy savings are even higher, 3 million BTUs per ton. The moral of this story is the longer, the farther you ship your recyclables, the more energy you save. No, but it actually illustrates the significance of in markets and the relative insignificance of transportation. The energy benefits of recycling are all about displacing virgin feedstock in production. Okay? And so it should come as no surprise that the choice of in markets matter. Where you send your recyclables is very important. If your goal is to generate energy savings, then you need to think about highest and best use. The energy benefits of recycling in Oregon are large. On slide 16, we estimate 30 trillion BTUs of energy saved in Oregon from recycling in 2005. Again, this comes out of the WARM model. It's equivalent to 2.6% of our total statewide energy use, or 237 million gallons of gasoline, which is a great way to communicate the energy benefits of recycling. Of course, most of these energy benefits are not petroleum. They're coal and hydro and wood. But still, people understand gallons of gasoline, and they see that 237 million gallons is a lot. That's how much energy we saved in 2005. The last example I want to share involves some work that we recently completed involving packaging. A few years ago, we conducted a pilot project with six businesses to see if they could redesign their packaging in a way that would prevent waste while also saving money. This is a voluntary, business assistance sort of project. Most of these businesses had a mail order or e-commerce order fulfillment operation. And at several of them, we were asked variations on the following question. When shipping non-breakable items through the mail or via UPS, is it environmentally groovier? We use that a lot out in Oregon, groovy. Is it groovier to ship the materials in a corrugated box with some kind of a void fill or some kind of a shipping bag? Slide 19 summarizes our initial response to this question. The boxes have a clear recycling advantage over the bags. Most of the shipping bags are either polyethylene or a poly paper blend. Recycling opportunities are very limited. Recycling opportunities for corrugated boxes are fantastic. You can also get high levels of post-consumer content in corrugated boxes, which you don't get in most of these shipping bags. So from a recyclability perspective, the boxes are the hands-down winner. However, as I mentioned, Oregon has statutory waste prevention goals, and waste prevention is about using less. Okay? The bags weigh 75 to 90% less than the boxes do. And so from a waste prevention perspective, maybe the bags are preferable. Oh, no. I'm a conflicted solid waste bureaucrat. I don't know how to answer the question. So wait. I don't work for the Department of Solid Waste. I work for the Department of Environmental Quality. Let's view this question from a broader view, a broader perspective of environmental impact. And so to answer that question, to conduct that view, we commissioned a life cycle inventory analysis. Metro, the regional government of the Portland area, and the EPA Environmentally Preferable Purchasing Program helped co-fund this study. It's an inventory analysis of 26 different packaging options. I've listed here our consultant team and the URL to the study and some brief summaries of the study if you'd like to follow up after the conference. Slide 21 shows the 26 different packaging systems that we evaluated. We looked at a corrugated box with 8 different kinds of void fills, 5 different kinds of shipping bags, some padded, some unpadded, all paper, all plastic, paper-plastic blends. Every time you see an asterisk, we also evaluated a lower post-consumer content option and a higher post-consumer content option. The next slide portrays the full life cycle petroleum requirements for our packaging options. Okay, This is million BTUs of petroleum per 10,000 packages. Up on the top, we have our low post-consumer content box with the 8 lower post-consumer content void fills. And so this is the range of results we get, okay? And then we have the higher post-consumer content box with the higher post-consumer content void fills. And then we have our 5 lower post-consumer content bags and our 5 higher post-consumer content bags. And much to the surprise of many people that we share this study with, including several of the businesses we were working with who knew, and they told us that, quote, plastic bags are evil because they are made from petroleum, unquote, we find that from a full life cycle perspective, any of the bag options, all the bag options, even the virgin plastic double-layered, bubble-padded polyethylene shipping bag that's made from petroleum, uses less petroleum over its life cycle than any of the corrugated box options with any of the void fills, even the all-paper options. Very surprising to many people. I'll explain why in just a moment. We're going to roar through the next 10 slides here for those of you on the webcast. That was petroleum. Let's look at a couple of other issues here. Here's natural gas. A little bit of overlap between the box and bag options, but very little. Coal. Pretty big difference there between the boxes and the bags. Solid waste. Atmospheric particulate. Atmospheric NOx. Boxes on the top, bags on the bottom. Atmospheric fossil-derived carbon dioxide. This doesn't include landfill, waste incineration, or forestry-related emissions or offsets. Atmospheric mercury, biological oxygen demand, waterborne suspended solids. We did 80 of these, but I'm not going to show you all 80 of the results. Anybody seeing any trends here? Any pattern that's emerging? Well, on slide 32, what we have here is this basic conclusion that the weight of the materials used is really the critical factor. All of the bags have lower burdens than any of the box and void fill options in almost all the different criteria we looked at because they weigh so much less. Even though producing a pound of polyethylene may require more energy and it may have higher emissions than producing a pound of unbleached craft, the fact that the bags weigh so little and use so little material, remember that upstream is where these large environmental impacts are, because they use so little material, that's why the bags end up having lower petroleum requirements, lower fossil fuel requirements, lower atmospheric emissions over their entire life cycle. That's the primary reason. The secondary reason is that the bags ship more compactly, both when they're empty and when they're full. And you can fit a lot more of them in a UPS truck driving across the country, and therefore you have fewer trucks on the road. And that also contributes to reduced emissions. And so this confirms indirectly the relative ranking of waste prevention and recycling in the waste management hierarchy, that waste prevention really trumps. It's really the better criteria to focus on. Recyclability and recycled content aren't very good predictors of life cycle energy use or emissions. One of the void fills we looked at was a 100% post-consumer content molded pulp flowable loose fill. It competes with the polystyrene loose fill, but it's made from old newspapers. Cradle-to-cradle folks love it because it's made from 100% recyclable material and you can recycle it. But when we conduct the life cycle analysis on it, we discover that there's a lot of natural gas used to dry that molded pulp void fill. So much so that 100% post-consumer content material uses more fossil fuels over its life cycle than any other void fill option, even virgin polystyrene. Okay? Now, having said that, I want to be very clear that once a business has chosen what material to use, once they've said, okay, I'm going to ship in a corrugated box or polyethylene or unbleached craft or whatever, then there are benefits to increasing the post-consumer content of that material. Right? And there are benefits to having that material recycled. So this isn't an anti-recycled content or an anti-recycling message. There are benefits to using recycled content, and there are benefits to recycling. But recycling and recycled content aren't a very good criteria for making purchasing decisions, we find, at least in this particular application. For those of you who are interested in looking more at this report, I would encourage you strongly to read the foreword and the preface of the report. It's not an anti-paper study. It's not an anti-box study. Corrugated boxes are a wonderful packaging material for shipping electronics and peaches and fruit of the month and other things that should never be put in a shipping bag. Do not try that at home, okay? And Another finding from our study is that the environmental burdens of production, again, far outweigh the environmental burdens of disposal. And for those of you who remember the TELUS Institute packaging study back in the early 1990s, they came to the same conclusion. To paraphrase Frank Ackerman, one of the lead authors of that study, "Well, nobody wants to live next to a landfill. It's far more helpful to live next to a landfill than to live next to a paper mill, an aluminum smelter, or an oil refinery. In the grand scheme of things, landfills today are not the menace that the general public assumes them to be. We seem to be doing a pretty good job with waste management, but perhaps we're not doing such a good job with materials management." This LCA has proven to be a very powerful way for us to illustrate the importance of waste prevention. I should mention that the larger packaging waste prevention project had several other useful results on slide 34. You'll see that the participating businesses are saving just shy of $1 million a year as a result of these voluntary packaging changes, and we were able to estimate for some of them the energy and greenhouse gas benefits of specific packaging changes they made, and they really appreciated that. So a few concluding thoughts. All three of these studies have confirmed that the waste management hierarchy is generally a sound rule of thumb. Ton for ton, prevention and reuse are environmentally preferable to recycling, and it is, in my opinion, a disappointment that so few programs reflect this. Per capita waste generation in Oregon has increased 43% between 1993 and 2005. We're drafting a waste prevention strategy framework to direct our work in prevention over the next 10 years, and I'd be happy to discuss that more during Q&A if you'd like. We also find that recycling generally has environmental benefits that exceed those of composting. And again, in the interest of time, I'll defer that discussion to Q&A if you're interested. So I'd encourage you to examine your frame of reference and ask, do you view the world through the lens of landfill regulation or broader goals of environmental protection? Do you work for the Department of Solid Waste or for the Department of the Environment? Is prevention, recycling, and composting about keeping stuff out of landfills, or is it about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, energy use, and other environmental impacts? If your only goal is landfill avoidance, then prevention, recycling, and composting are all comparable. They all keep stuff out of landfills. But I hope that landfill avoidance isn't your only goal, or even your primary goal, because environmentally, landfills and their impacts are much less significant than the upstream production-related impacts of materials. In my view, in many parts of the U.S., justifying waste reduction programs by talking about landfill avoidance is akin to encouraging people to stop smoking because you don't like the litter of cigarette butts. It's a fine reason to stop smoking, but it's not particularly compelling. At least not in many parts of the country, although there are exceptions. So we found that life cycle analysis is a powerful tool in solid waste policy and program development in Oregon. It's not a perfect tool by any means, but we're much better for it. It's been useful to us in prioritizing our efforts, for example, between different methods of waste management. It has tremendous value in communicating the benefits and the importance and the relevance of our work, both with the public and also with policymakers. And it's also helped us to conduct critical analysis of the conflicting morass of ideas and proposals that we all have to sort through every day. Remember the question about whether or not we could save energy by reducing the frequency of curbside collection. A few months ago, there was a very unfortunate article in USA Today about a medium-sized city that had just discontinued curbside recycling altogether. And the mayor of the city was quoted as saying, justifying the change because of all the energy that was being used to fuel the collection fleets. I don't know the details of that city's program. I thought it was a really unfortunate message. I have to assume that either the city had a really, really, really inefficient curbside program, or, more likely, that they never actually evaluated the net energy benefit of their program. And if that's the case, that's a tragedy, because EPA's WARM tool makes it so easy to do that. And had they conducted that analysis, they would have seen that curbside recycling is a net saver of energy, not a net user of energy. That's my comment. I'm going to close by paraphrasing Governor McCall and encourage you to enjoy the rest of your visit here and your conference. And when you're done, please go home. Not because we don't like you here. It's not that we don't want you to stay here or contribute to increasing waste generation or make it more difficult for us to achieve our statutory waste prevention goals or anything like that, but rather to protect the environment, to really protect the environment. From the major problems today, state solid waste programs across the country need to use tools like LCA to better inform our decisions, our policy, our programs, and our public outreach. For many of us, this is going to mean transcending the landfill-centric view of waste reduction and ending the blind pursuit of landfill avoidance and distinguishing between prevention, recycling, and composting, because they're really very different. So I hope that you found some of these ideas or findings useful or at least thought-provoking, but if not that, at least entertaining, and that you'll be able to apply them in your work when you return home. And in the meantime, please enjoy the rest of your stay and your time here at the conference, and thank you very much. Okay, so I guess we're going to take questions now, and Terry, you're going to take the microphone around. Because of the webcast, please raise your hand, and Terry will take the mic to you, and we'll also be taking questions over the Internet.
Thank you very much for that presentation. That was fascinating and entertaining and very informative all at the same time. I'm curious if the assessments that you have done looked into, for instance, when you worked in the voluntary program, the savings to the businesses, for instance, had businesses been using all boxes and then now are using boxes and bags, did that have an impact on their bottom line other than the environmental bottom line?
Much of that $993 or $4,000 in savings were from one business that actually had been using both bags and boxes and increased their use of bags. They found that they were shipping a lot in boxes that could go in bags, and that change increased their savings by about $650,000. We've got some case studies on our website for that link that describe some of the different things that the businesses have done. And the savings resulted from reduced purchasing costs, reduced labor costs because the bags fill more easily, and also reduced freight costs because, of course, UPS and FedEx charge by the pound. So the less heavy your packaging, the less you pay in freight. Other questions? Seems like there's a question coming from the web.
All right, this question comes from Peter Canepa with EPA headquarters. This question is, David mentioned that composting and recycling are the two general options for solid waste management. Why is incineration, with the cogeneration of electricity, for example, avoided burden in LCA, not an option for the long-term management of solid waste? Countries like Germany and Sweden have already implemented this as a viable solution.
Okay, great question. And I think it is and can be a long-term viable solution. I have this week all the way down the waste hierarchy. We're all familiar with some of the controversy around incineration versus landfilling. But definitely, we focus most of our efforts in Oregon looking at these waste reduction initiatives because our disposal infrastructure here is pretty well set. We have hundreds of years of disposal capacity. We're not seeing any incinerators on the horizon, any new incinerators. We do have two already. And so it's just not been so much of an issue in our analysis here in Oregon.
Let me get back here to you.
Okay. There's a couple questions in the middle of the room.
Dave, thanks for an excellent presentation. I really enjoyed that. One of the things that we're struggling with in Minnesota is trying to develop a cap-and-trade system that really supports the waste management hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of curious in terms of where the Oregon DEQ stands or legislators in terms of taking that information around the life cycle benefits of waste prevention, reuse, and recycling, and really being able to migrate that into a cap-and-trade system. It seems to me that kind of policy train is very much off and running, and that from the solid waste perspective, we haven't done a particularly good job in terms of really defining how we can actually make sure that those benefits actually are prioritized in a cap and trade or even potentially a carbon tax framework.
Excellent, excellent questions. And I wish I had more, I wish I could report that we were farther down that track. We aren't. We've not had that discussion here in Oregon. Only recently have people started talking more seriously about cap and trade, and we had some legislation this summer that's moving us in that direction. It's going to be a real challenge for the solid waste community to engage in that sort of upstream thinking around cap and trade. I'd like to learn more about what Minnesota's doing. Maybe we can get together afterwards and explore that. One of the core problems is the question of who owns the emissions offset. So, for example, if Minneapolis has a curbside recycling program and it collects a bunch of newspapers, and the newspapers, the OMP gets shipped off to a paper mill that uses them to make new newsprints and thereby reduces natural gas use, and there's significant benefits there, and also results in increased forest carbon sequestration, and then the St. Paul Pioneer Press uses that high post-consumer content newspaper, newsprint, to print its newspaper. Okay, there's a greenhouse gas benefit there that everyone would agree to. Who owns it? Is it the city of Minneapolis for generating the curbside recyclables? Is it the paper mill for investing in the technology that allows them to use that instead of wood chips? Is it the St. Paul Pioneer Press for buying the recycled content newsprint? Is it the forest owner, whoever they are, or however that works? Do the benefits get divvied up and everyone gets a third of the benefits? I don't know. There's some really tough questions there, and that seems to be at the heart of the problem. Yeah. Another question, from the web? Okay.
All right, we have a question from Sue Ann Murphy with DEQ in Michigan. Was a break-even point evaluated for polystyrene? Slide number 14.
No, but it would be easy to do. And probably, if you look at slide 14, most of the plastics tend to have pretty comparable energy savings per ton. And so you could look at LDPE and PET, and I think it would be fair to say that polystyrene is probably somewhere within 10 or 20% of those values.
I'd like to build upon your example of the mayor moving to a less or reducing curbside. I think I know that mayor, but I need help in limiting to which one. That would be a pretty common reaction,
right,
that we see. And while I think your point is excellent in sort of correcting his statement that we're saving energy, I think when you get down to it, from the city mayor's perspective, they're saving energy costs.
Yes.
And I just was wondering what you might be able to offer as an explanation as to why you should think more broadly than just his city budget to the broader environmental consequences.
Right. Very good questions. And I'm not familiar with the details of how the economics of that city's recycling program worked or didn't work. Recycling, without looking at externalities, pays better in some parts of the country than it does in others. There's no question about that. So I guess I'd have to, look at the details of that city, which I'm not going to. They're not in my state. But potentially, if they're open to it, explore the idea that government was created to solve problems that individuals couldn't solve by themselves. And there's a bunch of environmental problems that fit within that category. Solving those problems typically requires some expenditure of money. That's why we have taxes, to fund government's operations. Ideally, you'd have a recycling program that didn't require any additional expenditure. And there's all kinds of ways that you can work with, collection rates and whatnot to help make that happen. But there is a public purpose, a public service that's being met by recycling that's not accounted for in conventional, green-shaded accounting exercises, and that's where accounting for externalities and the economic benefits of those externalities comes into play. Jeff Morris, who's a consultant with Sound Resource Management Group in Washington State, has done some outstanding work for the Washington Department of Ecology around estimating the whole life cycle economic benefits and costs of recycling and monetizing these greenhouse gas benefits and some of the other benefits that aren't currently captured in the market, and demonstrating that even curbside programs that on the surface look like they aren't cost effective, once you add these environmental benefits in, the situation looks different.
Yeah, just a quick question about the carbon market and carbon credit issue. You touched upon the ownership issue, but the issue associated with actually the calculation of the carbon reduction. You talked about the warm model. What's your opinion in terms of how reliable some of the assumptions behind the models and et cetera, and whether or not you think that the market will actually take some of the information that's coming out of that model as something that they could trade in the market? It seems like everyone's relying on that particular model as being produced. I mean, everyone's using it to talk about our benefits. So it's talking about the benefits in terms of public policy making is a little different than actually people putting money to buy stuff. So
yeah, that's right.
Just interested in your thoughts about
it. You know, there are probably people in this room who have more experience with that than I do. I've not looked at this directly, off the top of my head, warm is being used because it's the best thing out there. It's a whole lot better than the alternative, which is not much. Can warm be improved? Yeah, probably. I think that for paper recycling in particular, where a lot of the greenhouse gas benefits are associated with the forest carbon sequestration module, that number is probably a bit softer and perhaps less concrete. I'd expect less willingness to put money on that portion of the paper recycling benefit because the number seems a little softer. But I don't know. I don't know how people are using this in carbon trading schemes. If others do, I'd love to hear how it's working and how it's not. Yes.
Yeah, comment. I worked with the city of Kansas City. They were doing a climate action plan. These were real rough envelope calculations. But basically, what they came up with was that improving the city's recycling rate was the most cost-effective way to improving their climate footprint of the city.
Overall.
Additionally, 6 or 8 years ago, EPA Region 7 provided some funding in Iowa to add back in waste diversion and recycling into the state's greenhouse gas action plan. And again, you could argue that the most politically feasible and cost-effective thing that they could do in Iowa to reduce their greenhouse gas footprint was to achieve the state's waste reduction goals.
That's great to hear. I should mention that the landfill gas emissions aren't that large in the grand scheme of things. What little I've seen on this suggests that it is very cost-effective to work on methane recovery. Even just burning it and flaring it, you know, achieves most of the greenhouse gas benefit. You don't have to do energy recovery to get most of the greenhouse gas benefit out of gas collection. And so, yes, both increasing recovery and increasing gas collection at landfills, and then also preventing waste at the source, as we've demonstrated, can also be very cost-effective. Oh, question from the web.
Yes, we do. We have a question from Jeff Sema with New York State DEC. Actually, I have two questions. First one, what metrics do you use to track progress in waste reduction or recusion, in waste recusion in Oregon towards state goal?
I don't know what waste recusion.
You may have meant reduction.
Waste reduction, okay. You know, different states use the word reduction to mean different things. We use the word reduction in Oregon to mean anything that keeps waste out of landfill legally, so it's prevention and recycling and composting. But I know that many states use reduction to mean what we call prevention. It's the use less stuff portion of the equation. I'm going to assume that's what his question is, and if it isn't, write back soon, okay? So our metric is a statewide waste generation number. We define, actually statute in Oregon defines waste generation as the sum of disposal and recovery. Recovery is recycling and composting and a small amount of energy recovery. And everything else that goes to incinerators is included in disposal. So we have this waste generation number, and we get it through our annual survey of landfills because they're paying us fees, per ton fees, and we also do an annual recycling and composting survey. So that gets us estimates of how much is recovered and how much is disposed of. We add them together, and that gives us generation. And then we have both a overall generation goal and a per capita generation goal in statute. That's our primary metric. And generation can be thought of as a rough measure of, it's basically most things that businesses and households toss out, whether it goes in the recycling bin or the compost bin or hauled to a transfer station or a compost site or a landfill, it gets counted. It doesn't include things that are resold, garage sales, thrift shops, etc., but that's relatively small. So it's a rough measure of everything that gets tossed out and is also a rough measure of everything that's purchased. Not everything that's purchased ends up in the solid waste system, and sometimes there's a delay, but on average, if waste generation is going up, it's a sign that people are consuming more. And we've seen between 1993 and 2005 that per capita waste generation in Oregon is up 43%. And most of that can be attributed to increasing consumption. A little bit of it can be attributed to shifts in how waste are being handled and counted. That's a whole other topic, so.
All right, the second question. Also, how does molded pulp loose fill use more energy even with highest post-consumer contact? Slide 32.
Yeah. The reason that the molded pulp uses more fossil fuels over its entire life cycle is that the way molded pulp is made, you take newspapers, you put them in a slurry, you get this pulp, and you pour it in the molds, and then you dry it. And the drying isn't done by sunlight. It's typically done by natural gas, although you can do cogeneration or burn wood or some other things. So the material we were looking at, the manufacturer of this product, was using natural gas. And it turns out that the natural gas used to dry the molded pulp is significant. Secondly, the molded pulp is pretty heavy. It's not particularly efficient when you transport it relative to some other void fills. You know, those plastic inflatable envelopes? They're not shipped inflated. They're shipped flat, and you inflate them in your warehouse, right? Some people were kind of surprised to learn that. No, we do not have trucks full of inflated envelopes driving up and down the interstate. Rolls of paper that can be crinkled up and stuffed in the box. Those are pretty efficient to transport as well. But molded pulp is a lot of airspace in those trucks. And so that also drives up the fossil fuel use for that particular packaging material.
We unfortunately have to call time on this at the moment. Sure, David will be around.
I will.
We can ask him questions. And again, would like to thank him for making a great presentation. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.